Hallo und willkommen zu unserem zweiten von drei Interviews mit Filmschaffenden aus der britischen Unterhaltungsindustrie. An den Mikros sind für euch Patrick
und Franzi. Unser heutiger Gast ist Douglas McKinnon. Der Name sagt vielleicht nicht jedem etwas, aber seine Arbeit auf jeden Fall. Er ist nämlich der Regisseur von Good Omens und mehreren Episoden von Sherlock, Outlander und vielen anderen Serien. An dieser Stelle müssen wir eine kurze Spoilerwarnung aussprechen. Es geht nämlich um die Sherlock-Folge The Abominable Bride. Und ja, wir reden da auf jeden Fall auch über das Ende. Das heißt, wer die Folge noch nicht gesehen hat, schaut sie euch vorher an und kommt dann ganz in Ruhe zurück zu unserem Interview.
Nachdem wir letztes Mal einen englischen Gast im Gespräch hatten, haben wir heute mit Douglas jemanden, der uns von der schottischen Perspektive auf die Filmindustrie in Großbritannien erzählt und von seinen professionellen und persönlichen Erfahrungen in Corona-Zeiten und im Lockdown berichtet.
Genau, und selbstverständlich haben wir am Ende auch nochmal alle Themen sowie unsere persönlichen Highlights und die aufschlussreichsten Momente für euch zusammengefasst. Also bleibt einfach dran für ein Fazit.
Wir freuen uns sehr, dass sich Douglas für uns die Zeit genommen hat und möchten uns an dieser Stelle nochmal bedanken und wünschen euch allen jetzt viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
We are going to start off with our first question regarding before COVID times. You have quite an impressive catalog of television credits, aside from directing many episodes of British crime dramas and internationally famous shows, which we'll get to in a second. You directed the film in 2006, starring Johnny Lee Miller, called Flying Scotsman. What made you venture into making a feature film, and how did you like the experience compared to directing television?
I think it's the challenge of doing something for the big screen is really interesting. Although screens, even since you know, the time I made that, screens have changed. So we've got our 65-inch television screens now in the sitting room. So it's not quite cinema, but it's similar. And we've also got all the laptops in the world and so on. So it's kind of getting blurred, that distinction. But I just always wanted to make a film. And in fact, we shot the cycling sequences in Germany for The Flying Scotsman in Westphalia. So it sort of... And I did the post-production in Germany as well. So that was all interesting stuff. I thought that would be good for your listeners, particularly, to know that. But yeah, it was a very difficult film to make, like lots of independent feature films that had trouble with financing. But the thing that I tried to do was just keep my eyes on the main prize, which was to make a film that could last a bit, you know. And we ended up being picked up by MGM, which was exciting, but nobody made any money out of it, so apparently. But again, that's typical of a lot of independent feature films.
Thank you for the info about shooting in Westphalia. The movie is a bit hard to get a hold of for over here in Germany, but once we'll get to it, I'm sure we can try to see and spot if there's something that we'll recognize over here.
Yeah, it was mostly the cycling sequences, the velodromes.
Okay, then we'll dive right into the second question. You directed a very special episode of Sherlock called The Abominable Bride. How did you feel about directing an episode of a well-known television show after it had already won multiple awards? And we kind of also want to know, was there a lot of pressure on you and could you still enjoy doing it?
Well, I'd worked with Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss and Hartswood, who made Sherlock, quite a few times before. The first time I worked with Stephen was on a show called Jekyll, which was a reworking, a contemporary reworking of Jekyll and Hyde. And then I'd gone on to work with both of them on Doctor Who as well. And I was kind of, they had made 9 episodes before The Abominable Bride. And I was both jealous and proud and annoyed and happy all at the same time as they made them. And then eventually the call came from Stephen, who told me first and said, he said, we're doing a special one. We're doing a feature-length episode. Do you want to come and do that one? And I went, yeah, yes, okay, as quietly as I could. But inside, I was jumping with joy because I couldn't wait to get a hold of it. And, you know, it's true. They had won lots of Emmys beforehand with the previous series. But what they hadn't won was the best television movie. And that's what my one did win in due course. But I remember at the rock party, Stephen saying to me that he thought that it would change my life and doing Sherlock. And I said, well, come on, it's kind of, you know, I've loved doing it, which I did. I've loved making it. It's been fantastic. But it's kind of like being the 10th guy on the moon. people are hard pressed to remember Neil Armstrong's name. Who remembers number 7? You know, who remembers number 9? And number 10? No, no chance. But you know what? He was right. The day after it won the Emmy, I got signed to American agents who I'd been talking to, but they just said after it won the Emmy, let's do it. And that in turn has changed my life. And Good Omens came out of that, and Outlander and Dirt Gently, and a lot of things came out of doing Sherlock. So I love doing it. I love making it. I'd love to do some more if they ever make any more.
That's really great. Thank you. What I particularly enjoyed about it was the costumes and the setting. Did you feel like that was a very special thing? Like, were you more honored to do that, or had you gotten used to it?
No, well, see, as much as I enjoyed doing Sherlock, the tricky thing about doing it was that they took away all the modern features that they'd worked so hard to build, you know, so they took away all the stuff with the handheld phones and you know, and all the stuff that is to do with modern life and Sherlock and Watson. But what I couldn't do was go back and just do what we'd seen before historically with Sherlock and just do, so I had to rebrand the rebrand and yet still make it very cool. And so costume was one of the things that we really looked at really carefully. And the costume designer, she'd won an Emmy for doing Sherlock, so I trusted her completely and she was amazing. And so we worked very hard to look at things holistically and look at things like the costume and try and work out what worked and what might not work. And one of the things I was scared of, we all were, was that it might turn into a parody of itself, you know, like it might go strange. And I remember standing in the costume department with Benedict Cumberbatch, and we had three objects. He had a magnifying glass, he had the hat, and he had a pipe. And he had all three, pipe in his mouth, magnifying glass, and hat. And honestly, it just looked silly. It looked really weird. It looked like it was a comedy we were making. And Benedict was going, I can't do this, you know? So I remember saying to him, well, take one away, you know? So he took the pipe away. And then we went, that's it. So that was our rule, that you could only have two of those three things at any one time. And it kind of gave a tone to the whole episode that I think worked, that we had to take it seriously and not make it funny and not make it ironic. It had to be real all the way through. And the fact that the way that Stephen pitched this story to me was, he said, we're going to start at the beginning with pre-titles with Watson being in the Afghan wars, and then people are going to think, oh, this is some sort of sketch that they're doing, you know, it's a joke. And then we're going to keep on going to the next scene, and we'll see Sherlock and he's in Victorian costume, and they'll think, oh, it's a pre-titles thing. And then we're going to redo the titles like they were Victorian titles, and people are going to think, this joke has lasted quite a long time. And then we're going to start telling the story completely Victorian and keep on going until after about half an hour, people will forget that the modern era existed at all, ever. And then right near the end, we'll reveal, actually, it's a mind palace thing that's going on. And so I know you started asking about costume, but everything came out of that initial thought to treat it like this, the contemporary series had never happened, and treat it like this was the first episode of a Sherlock Holmes that was a Victorian Sherlock Holmes.
I actually think that worked out really well. I really enjoyed the episode.
Good, thank you.
I have one more little fan question about it. There was a really cool flashback scene that you did where Lestrade tells everyone about what happened with the bride. Who came up with that? How did that come to be?
Those things are usually a mixture of the writing and the directing and the art department and so on. And this was no different. By the time they reached episode 10, their first director, Paul McGuigan, had come up with a lot of ideas about shifting things into the streets and fields and things like that. So Mark and Stephen had sort of knew how to write that down, but then I have to come along and actually visualise it and realise it. So some of the shots, like the shot where the guy freezes in the middle of the street when he's running, it's one thing to write it, it's another thing to actually make it happen, you know, and that was a very complex thing to do. And, you know, I say this really happily, that the budget on Sherlock, although high in British terms in those days, it's still a television budget. But what they're asking us directors to do is do movie things, you know, movie effects, with a television budget. And that can there's lots of trip hazards there. You know, we can fall over and it could be difficult. But I think mostly we got away with it, and the special effects won an Emmy actually that year as well. So we must have been doing something right.
Definitely. Thank you so much. I'm going to pass on to Patrick. I'm done with my Sherlock questions.
It's also interesting that you mentioned the thing about the poster shoot with Benedict Cumberbatch. I always wondered that it must require quite a lot of experience to actually get a grip of what works on camera but looks absolutely ridiculous when you see it in front of you. So that probably it takes a lot of experience and years of actually directing, and then a lot of patience as well, as I imagine.
It is. I think what happens is that all shows, if it's a new show, you have to find a new vocabulary. But a show like Sherlock had a visual vocabulary that you're silly if you're a director and it's been that successful and you don't try and understand and apply that vocabulary. And it's the same with Doctor Who and shows like that. You go in wanting to make the best ever episode of that show. And if you don't unpick the vocabulary visually and with sound and music as well, then you're sort of crazy, I think.
Since you mentioned the shows you worked on already, those huge productions like Sherlock, Outlander, Doctor Who, and Jekyll, which is so underrated, and I'd love to see a continuation of, even though it's unlikely to happen probably, but if it does, maybe they're going to approach you again since you did well on the episodes that already aired.
Funny enough, my wife is a painter, and she said the other night, do you mind if we watch Jekyll again? And I went, no, it's okay. I haven't watched it for 10 years or something. And so we've been watching it the last few nights, and well, quite a lot of it stands up. And I we have talked about doing more. And funnily enough, Stephen Moffat's son watched it a few years ago, and he was at the height of his success with Doctor Who and Sherlock. And his son said to him, "said I've just watched Jekyll. Why aren't you doing that instead of all this other stuff?" So I would jump at doing a feature of Jekyll, and I know Jimmy Nesbitt would as well. So
we'll just have to wait and see, I guess. So in 2019, you actually topped yourself after all these already huge shows by doing an Amazon Studios miniseries adaptation of the novel Good Omens, which you already hinted at. And if I'm not mistaken, this was the first time you worked on a series where you have directing credit for all the episodes. So how was it like to work directly with Neil Gaiman to bring his novel to the screen on such a huge scale? And how did it feel to have so much creative input on such a huge production like that?
Yeah, it was quite, I hadn't, there's a funny thing about Neil Gaiman. There's lots of funny things about Neil Gaiman, but one particular thing that I'd known his work, obviously, but I hadn't read Good Omens, the book. And when I got approached by the BBC to talk about doing Good Omens, and I read it and just loved it straight away, and then started to read the scripts. And I was born and brought up in the Isle of Skye in Scotland, in the Hebrides, which is, it's quite a big island, but people say that it's remote and everything. And it turned out that Neil Gaiman had a house on Skye, and the house is like a mile away from where I was born. So we immediately had that bond of talking about the island, and I ended up, he wrote it on Skye and wrote the scripts. And it turned out I ended up reading, just by chance, I was teaching at a college there, and I ended up reading the rest of the scripts on Skye as well. So Skye's a big thing for us. And so we connected at that level straight away. But creatively, we kind of just bonded straight away and had the same backgrounds. He loved Jekyll, for instance. He said when he'd seen it, he thought, that's somebody I'm going to work with one day. I said, why have you waited for 13 years then? And quite quickly, I found myself saying that even if I didn't direct it, I thought that only one person should direct it, because it felt like it was so complex tonally that to have the normal three or four directors coming in to do different episodes, it would be really hard for that vocabulary to kind of measure up together. And that I saw Good Omens as like one big film, not six parts. It feels like a big movie, not a six-part series. And I've got nothing against six-part series. It's just that's what I thought it was. And so I kind of put the argument to Neil, and he said, I was thinking the same thing. And so we put it to Amazon, and eventually, after a few months, they got convinced that it was a good idea. And Amazon have been amazing creatively to work with, and they give us complete freedom to make the thing that we had a vision for. And it was great. It's one of the best experiences of my life working on Good Omens.
You mentioned that in our last conversation, if I remember correctly, that if you have a great experience creatively working on a project, then that heart and passion just pours into the final project that you end up doing. I'm sure there are other great movies and series where people might have had very bad experiences on set and still showed.
I think it's possible to have a terrible shoot and a great movie, or the other way around, you know, have a great shoot and a terrible movie. And I try and avoid the terrible shoots, but because that's not very nice. But I'd rather a terrible shoot and a great film or a great series than the opposite, you know. But I do think there's kind of mythology around that I think is really based on people that probably are miserable anyway when they make things, you know. And I just, these days at least, I'm very lucky. I get to choose what I direct, as long as they choose me back. And I try not to have miserable shoots or bad movies or bad series. So I think having somebody is having a showrunner like Neil at the heart of such a thing, it just creates an atmosphere on set. He was there 75% of the time. It creates an atmosphere that even if somebody's having a bad day, and people do have bad days when we're filming, it's just human nature, we can pull them through that day. So hopefully they'll pull you through your bad day. So I think it, for me, it does come out on screen. If you have a very positive creative shoot with a crew and actors that want to be there and are loving the work, that's much better than the other way around. And also, I have to, another thing I should say is that television and movies get made in at different times. Sometimes television and films are made in the cutting room out of the stuff that people filmed. But my best experiences are when you get a hold of a great script and everybody reads it and just wants to work in it passionately. And I've been lucky enough to get, the thing that makes me happy is being the first to read Good Omens or Sherlock or Doctor Who and think, oh my goodness, I'm going to get to direct this. And I hope that carries on into the unit, it carries on into the cast, because they read the good work. It's much harder to direct a bad script than it is to direct a good one, put it that way around.
We're all in the same boat with this whole global pandemic happening. So we do want to talk about the current situation as well. What we really want to know is, in what way has the COVID lockdown affected your professional life, as well as if you have any special ways to cope with it personally?
So there's a few things on that, I suppose. I mean, I've been at home in Scotland since last March, although some of my colleagues in the industry have been out filming and everything, I was at a stage of pre-production or early pre-production of two series. And so life kind of carried on as it would have, except I was at home and not in an office somewhere. And, you know, like everybody, I think it was the day after lockdown in the UK, somebody said, do you want to do a Zoom call? And I said, what's a Zoom call? You know, and it's, you know, Zooms have dominated me just like everybody else. I'm working with Neil Gaiman on some projects, and he's in New Zealand. And it means that communication is complicated, because if we want to have a call that includes the UK, Los Angeles and New Zealand, there's only a couple of hours a day that can happen on when we're all awake, you know. So that's been a thing. In the last two or three months, I've taken to doing an hour's walking every day, and that's been really good for me, I think, and good for my family as well. I'm very lucky. I live near the coast, so there's a sea walk I take every day, and just walk for an hour and listen to documentaries and music and think about, you know, the stuff that I'm hoping to make later in the year. I think my biggest thing was I remember thinking last March or April, that I felt I had to be determined to come out of lockdown with more than I went in with. That was my plan. So that, I wasn't quite sure what the more was going to be. You know, I had thoughts of another language, all those books that you were going to read and everything else. But actually, funnily enough, the thing that I've been working on is getting two series moving, and getting ready to go when lockdown eventually finishes. So I'm hoping that over this coming winter, we'll be filming a couple of new series. What they are, I can't say because they've not been announced yet.
That's fair. Sounds very exciting, though.
And we've watched so much television. I've really loved it. It's because normally I don't have time to watch television a lot. I mean, I do when I can, but you know, watching entire runs of series that you've missed perhaps, or you know, things like Your Honor what was the chess one? Queen's Gambit. That was amazing. A few other things. I've watched a really obscure, or to me obscure, Japanese series called Midnight Diner, which is on Netflix, and it's just all about a little restaurant in Tokyo and just the people that come in and out of it. And it's not a big budget thing. But I got really entranced with that for a while. So yeah, that's been lockdown really.
We also wondered about the Scottish entertainment industry during lockdown. Is there even a significant difference between Scotland and the UK industry, or how does that work and how has it coped during COVID?
I think there is a difference because we're a separate country and with our own government and with our own television stations, albeit it's BBC Scotland, but it's Scottish television as well. And I think to give your listeners some sort of scale, I kind of think of it as a bit like the Czech Republic in size, you know, in terms of the industry. There's certainly, you know, it makes a big impact when shows like Outlander come and park themselves here for 7 or 8 years, because that's a big, you know, number of jobs. And I should say that's another part of my strategy for coming out of lockdown, that I wanted, if I could, to create lots of jobs in the industry by getting these series off the ground. And if they work, touch wood, that's what will happen, because like I say, there've been some people working, but mostly people like me have been, you know, not working. And I think what is going to happen though, when eventually we come out of all this somehow, is that there's going to be a flood of work, because kind of obviously there's a whole backlog of stuff that's not been made. So the Amazons and Netflixes and the BBCs are all running out of material. We can all see it on our screens. They're all running out of new shows because they've not been made. So I think there's going to be a flood of work, which is exciting. And so I think the recovery when it comes should be really fast and people should get a lot of work, which is great.
Speaking about your work, we're also in, concerning this show, we're very interested in the process of the entertainment industry in different countries. And you've worked intensely in both the UK and the US. What are some key differences in the work process of a director specifically between Britain and America?
So there's a few things that spring to mind. American directors who do the sort of drama that I've been doing are kind of much more used to, there was a sort of time period in the late 90s where American drama appeared to be at its peak, when Hill Street Blues and all those shows, West Wing, all those shows were coming through. And the showrunner figure emerged from, you know, the Aaron Sorkins of the world emerged. For directors, what they discovered was that the old studio system in the States meant that they would come in to do 4 or 5 weeks prep, shoot for two episodes for 4 or 5 weeks, and then do 9 or 10 weeks post-production, which is kind of the model that we still have in the UK. The American directors argued that they should just leave after the shoot and let the execs deal with the edit, which meant that they could make more money and do more work. It also meant that they missed one of the key bits of the process, but that's the way it was. And it's still true today that in most American shows, like when I did Dirt Gently and Outlander, I did prep and I did the shoot, but then 2 days later I left. Whereas in the UK, it's much more traditional for the directors to stay to the very end in post-production, do the edit, oversee the sound, do the grading of the pictures, and finally finish off the CGI shots. And my contention is, actually, with shows like Good Omens and the shows that I'm working on now, it's essential that you stay to the end, because actually to fully realise the vision, you need a pair of eyes that's there from beginning to end of the process. And I like to think that that's why shows like Sherlock and Good Omens are successful, because they they feel more coherent than perhaps some American shows do. And this is partly the reason. And then the other big thing I'd say is that the job of showrunner is a different job in the UK than it is in the States. In the States, it's very much actually like we did Good Omens, where a figure like Neil Gaiman is in overall creative control from beginning to end. He or she's choosing the props, obviously casting, has a say in locations, has a say in production design, has a say in costume, makeup, hair, everything, and goes into the edit and watches cuts. And so travels all the way through from a blank piece of paper to the finished thing on the screen. Whereas in the UK, it's tended to be more, even though some people have had the title showrunner, like the Stephen Moffats or Russell T. Davises or so on, up until quite recently, they were quite removed from the finished process. They might be the lead writer, but they might not even go to the edits, or they see the edit near the end of the process. So whereas I really like the showrunner model, because you've got a creative in charge of everything, and the money has to catch up with that, rather than the money leading and the creative's trying to fit in with the money. And there's always compromises on money. I'm not saying that, but working as a director through the whole process, but also working closely with a showrunner is a much happier experience, in my view, for me.
Our previous guest for this program was Samuel Barnett, who you've of course worked with on Dirk Gently, and he also said that there are massive differences, especially in obviously money management, but as a result of that, also in time management between American and British TV productions.
Another thing, talking about Sam, when I went to do Dirk Gently, it was the beginning of series two that I went to, so they had lots of processes that they had thing. I remember the first morning, I just sort of said, okay, can we clear the set for rehearsal? And everybody, the crew who were working away, getting things ready, sort of ignored me. And I said, no, I mean, I really want you to leave. And the producer came up and said, what do you mean? I said, "I the only way I can work is to have a completely empty set apart from the actors, including you, you know? And he said, well, okay, I've never heard of this before, you know? And I said, well, it's the way I work. And if you like the stuff that I did, which is presumably why I'm here, this is how I get it, you know? And so they cleared the set. And I remember Sam going, but his jaw just dropped to the floor. And he said, we've never had this. Where we just rehearse? It's amazing. And it's interesting. That producer came back on when we did what I call the crew show about 15 minutes later. And he said, what if this doesn't work? Because we don't work like this. I said, well, give me 3 days of filming and work this way with me. And then if I'm behind on the schedule and you don't like the dailies and you don't like the rushes, then we'll change it back to your system. How's that? He went, deal. And we never changed it back because it all worked and they were very happy.
Mission accomplished, I guess. That's actually pretty nice to hear, because Dirk Gently is such a very British property that it's nice to see that the British way also bleeded into the American show during filming.
Yeah.
So we can just all hope that the COVID situation especially will improve in the near future. Right now, it looks like the lockdown in England might be lifted by June 21st. So what are some hopes or even perspectives that you have for the time after COVID, apart from the two shows that you already talked about?
So we have a different way out. So June the 21st is not a target for Scotland. That's just for England.
What is the target for Scotland, do you know?
Well, the way that Nicola Sturgeon, our First Minister, is running things, instead of it being, I think what the government felt was that instead of there being a target, a date to aim at, you know, sadly for us, COVID doesn't have dates built into it. It was a bit, you know, I don't know what happened in Germany, but over Christmas here, people sort of said, oh, we'll just get together on Christmas Day, you know, and it'll be fine. And I remember thinking, has somebody told the disease about Christmas Day that it has to stop, you know? And we had the biggest surge in the new year that we've ever had because of that. Lots of people died because we had Christmas Day. And so I think in Scotland, what we're doing is we're looking at the vaccine rolling out. We're looking at the illnesses of people that are in hospital and also, sadly, the people that are dying, and watching the figures come down. And I think the roadmap out for Scotland will be controlled by that and not by an arbitrary date somewhere in the future where the pubs all open and everything's back to normal. I think it's a really weird concept. I do think psychologically, for the whole world, when the vaccine is rolled out, or in New Zealand's case and a few other places, they managed to control it. It's when the hospitals aren't full and people aren't dying as much. There'll come a tipping point where everybody goes, actually, I feel okay about going out now, you know, theatres and football stadiums. It's going to be a really difficult thing to police, because it means that, you know, like most of the world, in the UK, we're working our way through from the oldest people first and the most vulnerable people first. So it means that, let's say in England on June the 21st, all the pubs just come open, but you're not allowed in without the double vaccine. Most people under 30 wouldn't have had the double vaccine. So what do they do? You know? And I think there's really difficult human rights dilemmas here, because I think it's really difficult dilemmas coming up, you know, that are quite fundamental. But as usual, the mass will win, you know, that's what will happen. The masses will win. And we're all risk takers every day we step out, aren't we? You know, one way or another, you know, I think in the end, we're all social creatures. So in the end, we'll go out of the house, you know, in the end, we will.
Again, we really, really appreciate you taking the time, Douglas, and wish you the best of luck for your future, personally and career-wise, and are very excited for the announcements of the series you're working on.
Definitely, so excited.
Good, I look forward to sharing those with the world. Okay, thank you very much. Thanks for being such kind interviewers.
So, nach dem Interview haben wir, wie versprochen, natürlich auch ein Fazit für euch. Patrick, was war denn für dich der informativste oder aufschlussreichste Moment im Interview?
Mich hat es persönlich sehr gefreut, dass er doch sehr ausführlich über Jekyll geredet hat. Die Serie habe ich damals gesehen, als sie noch relativ neu war, und sie ist leider nicht sehr bekannt. Aber gerade deswegen war es für mich ein schöner Fanmoment zu sehen, dass er und seine Familie, wie er erzählt hat, noch so an die Serie zurückdenken und dass anscheinend auch viele der Beteiligten interessiert sind, eventuell ein Revival oder einen Spielfilm daraus zu machen, wenn es jemals passieren sollte. Also falls das Revival jemals passieren sollte, habt ihr das hier zuerst gehört.
Auf jeden Fall. Ja, ich hatte auch so einen kleinen Fan-Moment, nämlich als er von diesem total lockeren Gespräch mit Benedict Cumberbatch erzählt hat, in dem es darum ging, wie viele Accessoires sie jetzt eigentlich Sherlock Holmes noch anlegen können, ohne dass es eben ein komplett lächerliches Detektivkostüm wird. Und ich habe darüber nachgedacht, wie ich in einem Gespräch mit Benedict Cumberbatch wäre, und dachte mir so, das ist so cool, was sie da für ein Level von Professionalität reinbringen.
Absolut, ja. Und gerade das war für mich auch ein sehr interessanter und aufschlussreicher Moment. Und er hat ja auch erzählt, dass das viktorianische Setting eventuell nicht funktionieren könnte und auch lächerlich wirken würde. Und das war für mich sehr überraschend, weil man sieht, dass auch jemand mit jahrzehntelanger professioneller Erfahrung in der Regie oder in der Unterhaltungsbranche trotzdem noch bei so einem großen Projekt nervös ist und nicht weiß, ob es funktionieren wird oder nicht. Aber unserer Meinung nach und anscheinend ja auch der generellen Meinung der Sherlock-Fans hat es in diesem Fall ja zum Glück geklappt. Trotzdem interessant zu sehen, wie bodenständig und menschlich in der Hinsicht er auf unsere Fragen geantwortet hat.
Ja, auf jeden Fall. Darauf bezogen hat mich auch total beeindruckt, dass er eine zielgruppengerechte Antwort parat hatte, dass sein Spielfilm Flying Scotsman in Deutschland gedreht wurde und uns auch nochmal genau gesagt hatte, welche Szenen wir uns da anschauen können. Fand ich auf jeden Fall sehr spannend, und man hat gemerkt, dass er sich einfach wirklich Gedanken gemacht hat vor dem Interview. Ich fand es auch gut, wie er auf unsere Frage zu den Corona-Folgen reagiert hat, dass es sehr interessant ist zu sehen, dass er eben auch auf bodenständige Bewältigungsmethoden setzt und dass es eben danach geht, ab wann ist das Virus so bewältigt und es sind so viele geimpft und wir haben so wenige Neuinfektionen, dass es auch in der Branche einfach auf professionellem Level weitergehen kann.
Wie ihr hört, konnten Franzi und ich beide sehr viel aus diesem Interview mitnehmen und waren sehr froh über die Gelegenheit. Wir hoffen, euch hat es auch gefallen, und wir halten auf jeden Fall Ausschau nach seinem neuen Projekt, das er angeteasert hat. Wir sind sehr gespannt, worum es sich dabei handeln wird, und hoffen, ihr schaltet auch bei unserem kommenden dritten Interview ein. Das waren für euch Patrick
und Franzi.